Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Paolo Gerbaudo, senior researcher at the Political History, Theories, and Geography Department at Complutense University in Madrid.
Well, it's great to see you, Professor Paolo. Thank you so much for being with us. And I'd like to begin by asking you, what is dynamizing, concerning, preoccupying, illuminating, interesting you right now?
I mean, one major object of concern for me now is how the public sphere is changing away from early social media, say social networks, towards a new kind of social media. I kind of conceptualize it as second generation social media, which is exemplified by TikTok, but more generally has to do with these diffusion, with this generalization of recommendation algorithms, recommender systems, which is one of the perhaps most unsung technologies of these days. Nobody really cares about recommender systems. You know, AI has much greater clout, but recommender systems are in a way much more consequential. They are in a way really existing AI, so to speak. They are these systems that basically determine what we see in our newsfeed, what we see when we open TikTok, but also Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and so on and so forth. And my concern right at this moment, in a way, is what I'm kind of working on right now as part of many other research interests, is how we conceptualize the publics that go with this media. So I'm toying with the idea of kind of recommended publics as an alternative to the networked publics, right? The people discussed connection to social media.
One of the things that's coming up as interesting at the moment is new data that suggests that political tendencies in the wealthy democracies in digital media are no longer coming from Facebook or TikTok or Instagram. They're coming through WhatsApp and Weibo and Telegram. They're coming from groups of known people who may be known interpersonally or may simply be part of groups that are there because of neighborhoods or families or religions or whatever. This is very new information, right? And it's very powerful. And we're going to see a massive influence from this in the expenditure on the US national general election in November. But none of it will beat the money spent on television. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Television will always, as long as you and I are alive, get more money dedicated to it by political campaigners than anything that isn't a big screen in the corner. These are some of the interesting realities we're facing. One of the algorithmic problems that I'm confronting, and I'd love your help with it, is this. So I edit a couple of journals, and one of the things that publishers do when manuscripts are sent to them for blind review is propose to editors 30 expert reviewers, potential reviewers, based on algorithms. And to give you a not very fabricated example, if I'm looking at a manuscript and I'm looking for reviewers and it's about people learning Hebrew in Iceland, I am going to get a bunch of reviewers recommended whose work is about the long-term tendency towards cancer from survivors of the Holocaust. Or I'm going to get bunches of recommendations to do with how language works for African Americans in terms of secondary language acquisition. In other words, I am constantly fending off madness in algorithmic recommendations, not incredible precision. And it seems to me that the frontier for algorithmic recommendations is actually penetrating Telegram and WhatsApp and WeChat as much as anything, because there you can get inside groups of people who have something in common. So this is very early, as I said, of thoughts on my part, but it's those two things are preoccupying me. First of all, the new tendency for political information to be shared not in established social media. What you were saying was the first stage of the public sphere in digital social media, but a second age, as you've been calling it, and I think that's right. And then the other thing is just how pathetic these algorithms are. I mean, as a kind of user, they're terrible. I mean, Netflix and Amazon do not know what interests me, even though they have unique access to what I spend time watching. So, can you explain to me why these things are so awful, as in badly done, and yet why you and I are probably both afraid of them and their impact?
I mean, the first question I think is very topical. I mean, how, what is happening now with these, I would almost call it anti-social media backlash. It's a sort of social media malaise of sorts that is pushing people to other media that are still partly social media, but are not social media as we conceive them, say, in the early 2010s. And it's a very interesting moment in time because you really see how this very fast development. It's 20 years since Facebook was created. I mean, this year is quite significant. And in these 20 years, so many things have changed. Partly, social media become part of normality. They become a fixture in the media landscape. But also, they enter the phase of plateauing, namely kind of leveling off in terms of growth rates, and a phase where they have no much, there's not much more room for growth. Actually, there is a kind of slight decrease. Some people are referring to anchitification, namely this kind of slow decay of these social media. Now, like you look at Facebook, like there is this legacy service, which is social networking, but it's as if it's kind of slowly declining. And that has happened with many other social media. Now even TikTok is almost kind of entering the kind of maturity phase, right? So it's crazy. And people, yes, are moving off, are moving out, kind of in a way spreading out, because these were kind of general social media. They were, I'm talking about Facebook, I'm talking about Instagram, I'm talking about Twitter, where you could discuss on the same platform, in the same room, so to speak, in the same arena, about anything and the contrary of anything, right? Which meant also that you were very exposed to the public eye on anything you said. So it was an horizontal platform, not much in terms of kind of power relations or hierarchy, but in terms that, or the fact that all the different topics and industries, so to speak, all the different spheres of your social life were integrated, which also meant that, for example, your future employer could look into your past post about politics or whatever may be of interest. While now the difference, marketers, and I think is very important to take marketing seriously and always keep an eye on social marketing consultancies, because their job is, for good or ill, often for ill, keeping track of the new trends. And now what they are speaking about, and they have all this kind of jargon of novelty, right? And part of their jargon now is the idea of verticals, as they call them. So verticals is basically is niche social networks that are very kind of topic specific. They are industry specific. They are activity specific. Sometimes they can coexist within the same social network. I mean, foremost example of that is Reddit, you know, like different subreddits. So which means that these are more secluded communities, but also more inclusive, right? There's a sort of trade-off between inclusion and openness. And they are also, in a way, more protected. I mean, in the case of Reddit, they are anonymized. In the case of WhatsApp groups, they are friends groups or groups where you can maintain kind of some degree of protection. And I mean, TikTok partly is also that. It's a place where you can consume without having to show, without having to perform, without having to be in the public eye, without having to be judged. There is this very nice book by Julian Rose now on Perfect, They're discussing this kind of constant pressure of being judged online. Yeah. So there is this, I think on the first question, this is a very interesting trend. And there's been a kind of, in a way, an excess of exposure brought by first generation social media that prompted people to speak out, say what you think, say who you are, without taking into account also the consequences of that, that all of that is recorded, right? That all of that may kind of be used against you. Yeah, that all of that subjects you to trolls, criticism, and so on and so forth. And now, therefore, there is a kind of a reaction against that, which goes into these messaging groups, into these verticals, or into this lean back mode of consumption. Basically, it's not really interaction; it's more honestly, we should call it consumption, which is what was going on, for example, with TikTok. And on the second question, perhaps I'm less qualified in terms of, I mean, as I don't know much about kind of AI algorithms as such, so a recommendation system and a kind of specific subset of that. Though in a way, what you're talking about are recommendation algorithms. Yeah, what I don't know if I can tell you why they're so bad at doing this specific task, but my guess is that, I mean, there are areas of extremely specialized knowledge, as the one you are referring to, which are beyond the current capacity of large language models, and which often, in more than artificial intelligence, sounds like artificial stupidity. When they're conceived of as autonomous AI, that's where the problem arises, no? Because at best, they should always be considered as tools that reduce your amount of work, but will never be able to kind of substitute your work, especially if your work is such expert knowledge based as the work we are doing.
Thank you for that answer, which I suspect inferentially is correct, but I am still amazed by how dreadful these proposals are. Almost nothing is recommended to me by publishers as a potential reviewer list is usable. The vast majority is absurd, not because the people are no good, but because they work on something different. You know, it could be someone who does astrophysics and somebody who does broken legs when what you're asking for is divisions in the former Yugoslavia over the European Union. I mean, that's how bad it is, right? In any event, away from my personal obsession and onto things that are more germane to your work. And I wondered if we could start actually by talking about your pretty recent, very notable book, The Great Recoil, which is a remarkable volume, indeed, came out in a sense in during COVID-19, if we can even say there isn't a during COVID-19, because it's clear that it's still going on. Like Ukraine, where it once had a fight over headline status, it now has to struggle to get anywhere near headline status. But your book is subtitled Politics After Populism and Pandemic. It's a terrific book. It's a very important one that looks at questions of nationalism, sovereignty, democracy, and new ideas of the social order. So I wonder if A, you could tell us what you were getting at in the book, and B, whether anything's changed in the last 3 years since it came out. It's probably 4 years since you actually wrote it, I imagine. Or getting on 4 years.
It was quite a long, was in the making for quite some time, the book. Actually, I mean, it had quite a bit of a genealogy, in the sense it's one of my more say, political books. Say, every I do a more kind of media sociology book, and then I do a more kind of political sociology or political. This one was a kind of more political theory book, really. It's a book that looks into political philosophy and creating a dialogue between political philosophy and current events. Yeah? And the thesis of the book is a bit of a provocation in the sense that what it says is that our favorite enemy, as kind of leftist academics, namely neoliberalism, perhaps is not anymore the right referent for what we are fighting against and for the kind of scenario we are operating within. Because for a long time we have had this impression that was kind of not just an impression, was a kind of was something that had to do with our experience that we lived in a market society dominated by a neoliberal ideology, and neoliberalism served to explain many things that were going on in the world. Something about ideology, obsessive individualism, the values that were structured in political discourse, people's subjectivity, was telling us something about the mode of production, the mode of entrepreneurial organization, the mode of accumulation. This was the real power of the notion of neoliberalism, which was a sort of string that was intersecating all these different planes and holding them together. But more and more, I think we've come to realize, and my attempt was kind of methodologically is basically a study of political discourse. Its material are excerpts from speeches, interviews, declarations, policy manifestos, slogans, the political discourse and its unconscious or subconscious. And what I came to realize, but I think I was certainly not the only one to realize, was that since 2008 specifically, there have been many manifestations of the contradictions of this idea of the market society. That actually there was premise on this idea that if the market was winning, the state in a way was losing, and which was what Thatcher and Reagan, right, were promising to do. Less state, pushing back the frontiers of the state. The state is the problem. Instead, we realized, A, that the market exists only through the state, thanks to the state. This was something that the less disingenuous neoliberals were already admitting from the very start. But also we have come to see how actually contemporary capitalism is more and more also very much a state-supported capitalism. Multinationals are not really completely autonomous sovereign bodies as they were conceived of. They are, in a way, long arms of their respective sovereign territories in many respects. We see that China has entered the battle for technological supremacy very strongly, adopting the typical policies of a developmental state, namely a state that invests heavily in technology, tries to preserve its leading companies, its leading products. And in turn, it has forced the US, especially with Biden, to react to that in a way to copy from China. Mean, there is a quite curious shift in our Western imagination about China. So China was the country that copied us, the famous Shanzai. Shanzai is basically the Chinese term for copying something, for faking something. So from cars to electronics, there was indeed a reverse engineering practice from the Chinese. Well, now, and TikTok is precisely an example of that, now many Western companies are copying from TikTok. They're trying to imitate. And also at a scale level in state policy, now countries like the US are trying to do not everything China does, but to learn some lessons from China. Which, to move to a conclusion of this answer, have to do a lot with overcoming kind of market absolutism. So, for example, I'm referring to the Infrastructure Act. So, public investment was one of the most sacrificed elements of public spending, which is the reason why the US now looks like an industrial archaeology park rather than the country of the future. Everything is rusty. Everything looks like a Martin Scorsese movie because much of the infrastructure is from Martin Scorsese early films. Looks like that. Or think about New York Underground, right? I mean, it looks old because it is very old. Now there's been a returning drive for public investment. So realizing that the market works only if there's public investment. And the other aspect there is also a conception that the Chinese have from Confucianism of equilibrium, of balance between the inside and the outside. So namely that there are areas of the economy that are too important to be left to the market. These are for the Chinese doctrine of the double circulation. They are food, and already Imperial China, the Imperial granaries were already kind of doing that thousands of years ago, like preserving food, controlling food, energy, and technology. Then when it comes to textiles, to household goods, to shoes, which were in fact the commodities that the Chinese excelled in during their early miracle, right, in the 90s, those, according to this doctrine, can more or less be left to the market, you know, because they are not kind of strategically important. But there are other things that are too important systemically, and therefore need to be under the control of the state. So, I mean, this is just one example of many domains where in public discourse, it is now, if not widely accepted, it is now again an issue in question what the role of the state and the market should be. So there is not anymore this assumption that the state is always bad and that the market is always the solution.
If we think back to the end of the Cold War, the first and second, then the second Cold Wars, so the Cold War from after World War II through to détente, and then the second Cold War of Reagan, the end of the second Cold War, we were told in wealthy countries, capitalist countries, we would get a peace dividend. And this peace dividend, you're probably too young to remember this, Paulo, but it happened during your lifetime, was meant to be a reallocation of resources away from military expenditure and into infrastructure and health and education, all those things. Now, as we know, none of that happened. The military has got bigger and bigger in many societies. In fact, the military is the functional infrastructure of the United States, just as it is the functional employment program for young people in the United States. But what's happened now, as a third Cold War has begun, with China and Russia as equal perils nowadays in this imaginary, is there's a return to what happened after the Second World War, which is a great bounty for all kinds of intellectual and public work based on the notion that you cannot just invest in the military. You have to invest directly in this stuff. So I think that's one of the fascinating things. And of course, we're seeing a massive remilitarization of so-called Western Europe in the face of terror at the possibility in their imagination of Donald J. Trump winning the next national election and the United States effectively or actually withdrawing from NATO and Russia actually being interested in going to war with the rest of Europe. These things are forming a new constellation of relations at the geopolitical level, I think.
Completely. Yes. This is also why there's so much discussion about geopolitics these days. Often, and many people are trying to kind of improvise themselves as geopolitical analysts, especially Italy is one of the countries where geopolitics, right? But I think it's something that is happening everywhere, right? But it's for a reason. And the reason is that before there was a sort of stable geopolitical imaginary, this imaginary was about globalization, which was globalization under the US unrivaled status as world hegemon, which is in turn, I mean, what Arrighi, the famous Italian political economist, would describe as the moment of peak of a certain capitalist world system. After the first world came Genoa, then came Holland, the Netherlands, then Britain, and then the US. And at the peak of it, these different world systems, these different globalizations, fundamentally, there was a moment of peace, like Pax Britannica, no? And then Pax Americana. And before that, there were moments of relative peace, moments of stability, where you temporarily had the impression that, in a way, international relations didn't matter that much, right? That war didn't constitute anymore. There was war, but it was a regional war. It was kind of peripheral war at the margins of the system. Well, now instead, we are entering what, according to Arrighi, is a moment of interpower rivalries. So there are different powers, most notably the US and China, that are reconstituting kind of their antagonism, though they were the two components of globalization. The two pillars of globalization were the US and China, on the Sino-American axis. And they still have a lot of shared interest, in fact. So, but this completely reshuffles many assumptions that we have. We had, for example, Europe, like being fundamentally peaceful, a continent that didn't have to worry much about security. The European Union has been kind of not under threat, but being European Union basically being able to have the privilege not to think about anything else but the market, to just conceive itself as a market, right? Which is a kind of something that from Pollyanna, not from better times. Better times that breed weak politicians, as the famous meme would say. So I think this is what is interesting now about the kind of the collective imaginary, right? That there is this moment of where legacy assumptions are cracking, and many things are now again kind of in discussion.
We've had this explosion of the emergence of two monumental reserve armies of labor in China and India. And also now we're seeing my cat is digging his claws into my left knee, Professor Paolo. The pod cat, Chinguri, aka Naranja, has dug his claws in. Now he's walking away. This is better. In addition to this, these two massive reserve armies of labor that have emerged in the last 3 decades, there's also been, and this is anthropomorphic of me, but a reserve, what I call a reserve army of natural resources, in that there is this desperate search in the global north for a means of sequestering China so that its logistics for any military escapades can be cut short by the United States as required, and B, a substitution for both its very parlous natural resources, but very valuable ones, namely rare earth minerals, and the much more plentiful and equally important natural resources of Russia. So the US and other countries engaging in environmentally criminal acts of fracking, for example, but also massive investment in the Nordic countries in the extraction of rare earth minerals to counter Chinese hegemony in the balance of trade. Very similar to what they did in the 19th century that enabled them to move from being peasant rural economies to industrialized wealthy nations when they found in the Sami people's traditional territories natural resources that they needed. In those days, it was what became ball bearings. Now it's what goes into cell phones, right? But it's the same sort of story. But again, as I say, it's confronting these massive forces that are about a battle for natural resources and finding them in places where it was thought they didn't exist. Chile, Australia, Sweden, Norway. To fight off China's natural resources and drawing or finding alternatives to dependence on Russian gas, for example.
Yes, this is very fascinating. I know it's a subject that you've been working a lot on. I mean, the question of natural resources as they connect with media, with digital media. And it's we always need to be reminded, right, that many, especially the applications that are the most intangible, actually they have a very material base, They look so intangible. The more they have a very heavy material base, a lot of labor going into them, a lot of expenditure on natural resources. I mean, recently I've been studying the case of the Chinese EV sector. So I've been doing some investigation on that for a report I've been writing. And that is a very interesting case because it intersects all these different rare earth materials, which are used for not for the much for the battery, but for the motor, for the electric motor. So
Oh, right. Okay. I didn't realize that.
for the permanent magnets
Oh, yes, right.
going to the electric motor. And in China, and it's quite striking. I mean, the developmental policies that China's been developing and has been developing for many years. I mean, basically since the turn of the millennium, basically it decided, right, as with 5-year plans and coordinated action that they wanted to become leaders, world leaders in the EV car sector. And now they control, I mean, besides being the largest producers of cars and specifically of electric cars and largest exporters of cars in the world, they just snatched the title of world top exporter away from Japan, right, which was the previous leader. They have achieved, I mean, in many respects, I think like Westerners will need to come to term with the world in which in some technology areas already, and likely in most technology areas, they will not be the leaders anymore. They will be second best. They will need, therefore, to catch up. They will need to leapfrog in those areas. And one of these areas is EVs and battery technology, because battery technology is the engine, metaphorically at least. It's not exactly the engine, but it's the fuel, say, more than the engine of car technology. And lithium batteries, they've been a revolutionary invention that has changed so profoundly so many sectors of our life. I mean, we are using now lithium ion technology. When we are using on our phones, we are using lithium ion technology. When we are using an electric bike, we are using lithium battery technology. And now that the same technology that powers our iPad and our old Nokias of the 90s is the same technology that now powers Cybertruck. It powers, like sports utility vehicles, and perhaps soon also trucks, and it powers buses. The Chinese government, of course, kind of exploiting its authoritarian system, managed to do is to pursue this very coordinated industrial policy. And now, besides being the top producer, it controls 80% of all the input products going into EVs, namely batteries, namely microchip, namely rare earth materials, namely lithium refineries. So lithium is interesting because it's not really a rare material. It's one of the most common metals that there are on the earth crust. However, its exploitation, its convenient exploitation, requires levels of concentration, the likes of which at the moment are only present in very few areas of the world, specifically, most notably, of course, Chile, Argentina, with new areas now kind of being explored for that. But then we have rare earth materials. Instead, China is really gifted with incredible with incredible share of control over these materials. I mean, if I don't remember wrongly, it's like almost 70% of all known mines of these materials. So this tells us just how and what they have also is logistics. I mean, China is described as a kind of logistical empire. So they have all these materials all in the same country, and also the refinery of this material in the same country, the assembly of this material in the same country, and the design is all in. So this is the incredible power that now China has, which also paradoxically means that China is operating in a kind of self-independence mode in terms of production, which is also turning away from the logic of globalization. It's not anymore a logic of long supply chains. It's a more risk-averse logic of just in case rather than just in time. Where you want as much as possible. Why? Because there's Houthis that may block the Red Sea. There may be war, regional or otherwise. There is climate change that will disrupt shipping lanes. Political stability is not to be taken for granted. In that context, also kind of from the managerial perspective, it makes more sense to have as much as possible of your value chain at hand, if not kind of, I mean, in your country, like, you know, or near shored, near shoring, as the saying goes. So there is a natural resource to play a key role in this type of imagination.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because this was something that we were saying 30, 40 years ago. It's clearly essential. And if you did so, you were just a fuddy-duddy. It's also interesting that the EU is flailing about desperately with initiatives coming willy-nilly hither and thither that are supposed to do something about these issues. But there's just a lot of talk, and it's not clear that the policies and programs will really work, but we'll see. They've identified the problem, I think. The question is what they're going to do about it. Yeah.
I think Europe, the European Union at this stage is in a very desperate situation. I mean, in the sense that it's in a worse situation than the US. It's in a worse because its institutional setup is not designed for times like these. So it's an institutional setup that is designed for times of peace and calm. Where you can do away, you can make do with loose coordination, where you can have a kind of open-ended architecture, right?
Yeah.
Europe is this kind of constantly expanding supranational network. I mean, it worked when it worked, but now it's definitely not working. Because also, I mean, fundamentally, there's no sufficient political will or sense of unity that, I mean, say on the one end, all European nation states are too small to do what they need to do to compete and to keep their status, say at least, you know, in this situation. But conversely, the European Union is too big to do anything that coherently. It lacks a sense of unity, a sense of cohesion, a sense of solidarity.
Yeah.
You need to mobilize huge resources to develop technology, also to develop, I mean, I'm kind of quite realistic in this. Yes, you need to develop defense. Right, you need not to kind of do an arms race, but it's fine. I mean, you should have an army to defend yourself. Any kind of democratic bloc or nation has it. But for example, for any of that, the European Union doesn't have the necessary political will
And the same with
to
the
give
problem,
companies, rich people to pay taxes, and you know.
the same problem that it confronted in 2008 because of the euro, the fact that the euro meant that the traditional capacities of a democratic government, namely to alter monetary and fiscal policies at times of economic difficulty, that capacity was halved
Completely.
because, you know, they didn't have the ability to alter the money supply. Prof, I wanted to ask you about an earlier book of yours, now 5 years old, Digital Barricades. And Digital Barricades is about the way in which politics changes with digital democracy. And perhaps this relates to your opening remarks about alterations to the digital public sphere. Could you take us back in time? Imagine that Totti is still playing for Roma. Imagine that Christian Vieri is not in Miami playing beach volleyball, but is in Australia learning about cricket. He's a big cricket fan. He knows a lot about it. Yeah. So to the time before digital barricades and the moment of digital barricades, what was going on before you wrote the book, and while you were writing it, what was happening to influence what you produced? A fantastic book.
Basically, when I started working on these topics, it was in the early 2010s. So in the first book I wrote on that was Tweets on the Streets, which was looking at Occupy and the Arab Spring and other social movements and how they were using digital media. And at that time, there was so much optimism about the democratic potential of these tools. And about their ability to mobilize people, also because the space was far less saturated. The algorithms were much more favorable to new forces for the very simple fact that, I mean, the organic visibility you had on Facebook at the time clearly was a factor in these. In the rise of these movements, because you had something akin to what now would be kind of free advertising space. You would get a very high percentage of your contacts seeing your contacts, and given that there were a few pages at the time, say the late noughties, early 2010s, you had a lot of space that you could use to mobilize. And it was always more Facebook than Twitter. Now, the academics are in love with Twitter, and they've been overanalyzing Twitter. But Twitter is the elite media, and therefore elite media matter for certain things. They matter for knowing the pecking order of journalists and who is cool and who is not cool, and sharing your articles. But they don't matter much for mobilization. Not a single person has ever been persuaded on Twitter. I don't think there's ever been even one person persuaded there. While Facebook, for example, is a more mass media with diverse networks. I'm not saying now, but say in the 2010s, it really mattered politically. And that's why like Obama like famously invested much money there, while poor Ed Miliband invested all his advertising budget of the 2015 election on Twitter, which is basically tantamount to throwing money in the fire. But later, so it was quite interesting to see this change in perceptions and imagination around digital media. So at the beginning, there was this very optimistic view of what they could achieve. Of course, then okay, populism, right-wing populism, the 2015 migration crisis in Europe was a very important turning point in changing perceptions. Of course, Brexit, Donald Trump. Now, there was this perception that in a way the table had turned, and that now these social media were being exploited by right-wingers, authoritarians. And then when I wrote kind of like my four last book, so The Digital Party, I was more concerned with new party forms, the new forms of organization as they were emerging, like in Podemos, the Five Star, and these parties, all this idea of, basically this idea of direct democracy, of the fundamentally centered around online plebiscites. So let's all gather online and we are all equal. And we vote on everything, with the most radicals who thought that you could get rid of parliamentarians and substitute them with kind of ongoing referendums every day. The average citizen would go home and vote on whatever 37 amendments to the whatever the protest bill, which of course was unrealistic. But what I showed in that book was how much online plebiscites were contrary to the claim that they were a form of radical democracy. They were more used by the leadership of those parties to get the members of the parties to rubber stamp decisions that had already been taken from above. And invariably, those referendums would get very high shares of votes for the winning option, like 80 plus percent in favor, which was a glaring symptom of the fact that these were not real competitive elections between, you know, if you have a competitive election, of course, you expect the two options to get very close to one another. So, certainly not 80-20. They were not competitive elections. They were more propaganda opportunities for the leadership of the party to show that the base of the party was with them. And now, I mean, now partly those parties are, those online plebiscites between parties have been abandoned. Now it's Elon Musk who uses a lot of online plebiscites to show that he enjoys the status of people's champion on Twitter.
By the way, I should apologize, Prof. I called it Digital Barricades.
Course. The
And that's
series
the book
of
series
America.
that it's in. It's called
Yeah,
The Digital Party,
the
as you
book
say.
series.
My sincere apologies. Now, Prof. P, I need to go back to Chinguri. You need to go back to Marco and other things. I have two more questions for you, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you may wish. Does that sound okay as a way of concluding? So the first question is that you mentioned Giovanni Arrighi, who had a big influence on me, continues to have. I was interested in whether you might want to tell us a little bit about your view of some of the later Italian theorists who've had a big influence on the Anglo world, in part because of Antonio Negri, but other thinkers as well, and the notion, for example, of immaterial labor, the social factory, and so on. Do those things speak to you, and what's your view of some of those important intellectual and political movements?
Yes, I mean, as an Italian, you know, like Pasolini famously said that Italians are Catholics regardless of their belief because it is a cultural thing. And I think the same applies with post-operaismo, with autonomism. If you are on the left, it has been such an influential culture that almost you cannot avoid being influenced by that. And I've had kind of my complex relationship with it. I mean, and agreeing with certain things, disagreeing with others, especially when it came to more the kind of implications for political conduct or for political strategy. But in analytical terms, I think that it was a very, I mean, it's called Italian theory, as it is now sometimes framed, you know? I mean, more specifically, again, kind of post-operaismo. Figures like Antonio Negri and many others, they were incredibly predictive of the transformation of capitalism. They were incredibly predictive in terms of understanding what the service economy was going towards. And like Mario Tronti, you know, Workers and Capital, with basically, that is the founding book of the current of operaismo, workerism, was so prophetic almost in identifying how the factory would be generalized, right? How capitalism would move out of the factory and into broader society. So I think it was, is this definitely a current thought that was able to predict many of the changes that were happening in capitalism.
And my last question, Prof, before throwing to you for anything you'd like to add, is to ask you how you go about finding shit out. Because your work is very empirical and very theoretical. This should be ordinary, but it's not. It's a highly unusual, innovative combination.
So, how do I keep abreast of things? That's super difficult because I mean, my early research, which I enjoyed a lot, was very, in a way, ethnographic. It was very interview based. It was very immersive. It was about interviewing people. It was very expensive labor wise because, I mean, like for the first two books, I did a total of 140 interviews. I spent extended amount of time seeing countries. I was in the different protest sites of Occupy, the Arab Spring, Indignados. I mean, I still regard it as kind of my most, how would you say, kind of developed research, high quality research. Because with qualitative research, you can understand things that otherwise are very hard to understand. And most importantly, you can understand things from the viewpoint of the actors that are involved in a situation. And this is not just important ethically, as a matter of, you know, how you say, paying respect or, you know, being respectful of the subjects or the actors involved, but it is important because I think it's the best way often to understand systems rather than from a kind of the bird's eye view or God's eye view. It returns a much less vivid image of reality than seen from the viewpoint of actors that are entangled in situations and therefore have to struggle in order to make sense of the worlds they're part of. They need to make sense of the thresholds, of the obstacles, of the dilemmas. So by interviewing them, one gets a very vivid understanding. But as I said, it's a very expensive research because it takes so much time for interviewing, transcribing, analyzing. So I mean, in other research, like my last book was much more kind of like reading books and looking at passages of discourse. It was challenging in many other ways. It was more challenging perhaps conceptually, theoretically, keeping all these strands together. But indeed, keeping abreast of all this stuff is very difficult. I think that is the only way that to not go mad is to have good friends who tell you what to read. And to be in messaging groups rather than out in the open internet. To have kind of advice, very strongly trusted friends who tell you what you need to pay attention to.
Thank you for that very generous answer. And
That saves you, I think, 50, 60% of the time, you know, like in learning, because we are constantly on the brink of loneliness, I think, as academics. Writing pushes us towards loneliness. Our job pushes us towards loneliness. But then being lonely, we're also bad academics because it takes us much more time to make things, to figure things out.
what an answer. Prof, are there things that you'd like to add that we haven't touched on?
Think we touched on everything.
So thank you very much, Paolo. It's always wonderful to speak to you, just as it's wonderful to read your work. It's been a great privilege to talk this afternoon.
Thanks very much, Toby.